Ready?
This is the second time around. Welcome to Highway Diary. I'm your host, Eric Hollerbach. With me, an illustrious guest, only the second time on, but working a lot behind the scenes, Skylar Neal.
Yep. Skylar Neal. I'm here.
How you doing, bud?
I'm doing good. Chilling.
Man, we thought we were going to do a sketch today. Now, we are deep in production. Skylar Neal is the camera guy and editor and co-producer of three stand-up specials that we're producing. One is called Conspiracies and Dick Jokes. One is called Fart Porn in Beer Halls. And the third is called It's a Medical Device. For all them, we're shooting three sketches. One of the sketches is called Inferno Barbie, where we light a bunch of Barbies on fire. I scouted out a little nature preserve near your house, but it seems like as soon as we went in there today, it was not good vibe.
Yeah, as we were approaching it, because we were essentially just thinking, like, anywhere in the desert, because, so let's just explain. We have I'm sitting, my leg is next to a pink water bottle full of gasoline.
Mm-hmm. I just want to make sure we're rolling, we're good.
Yeah, I have a pink water bottle full of gasoline.
Yeah.
We have a bag of Barbies and yeah. Barbie doll cars in the back.
We got two Barbie dream cars. We got a Barbie dream horse. Mm-hmm. We have 30 Barbies in the back. We have a bottle of gasoline. We have a lighter with a long stem on it so you can be far away from the Barbie when you ignite it.
And as we were pulling up to the spot that we thought we were going to film at, there was a cop pulling into that spot.
Yeah.
So we were like, oh, we'll go to Joshua Tree, as I think we settled on. And
so we don't have a backyard. You know, we don't have a house with a backyard where we could just knock it out. So we kind of have to use public land. And in using public land, there's spectators. Yeah. Anyone can walk up on you. And when a cop pulls in. And then as we got to the trailhead, it said no fires. Don't set any fires, you know, because the Pasadena Hills have gone ablaze from arsonists who set fires, you know. So there's very stiff fines and very stiff jail time if you are setting fires around a canyon.
Yeah.
So we had to like postpone that shoot for a week's time.
We would have been able to run out to you today, but I already promised our time and Eric's effort away to CJ to record his set on his birthday, which I almost like second guessed as I was like when he asked, and I was like, because the experience before when Big Mike asked me to film his set at the Ice House, and I said yeah, but I like gave away your, I like volunteered your time and effort,
right?
And
then like we did a favor for another comic because we thought he would give us stage time so that we could perform and get some sets in LA before we hit the road. So in September we're gonna hit the road and we're gonna perform at in Las Vegas, in Mesa, Arizona, in Dallas, Austin, Houston, New Orleans, Atlanta, or North Carolina, definitely Washington, D.C., and then New York City. So we have this whole tour planned to get all the stand-up in. So we were hoping to get a couple of shows in L.A. before we hit that tour. So we were doing a favor for Big Mike to get us, so we would film a set, and then he would give us stage time. We filmed a set, and then he gave us stage time, and then like he gave me the light 2 minutes in because he's a dick. So
we set up to film the set. He didn't even go on.
Oh, that's right. He didn't even go on. He was supposed to headline.
He asked us to.
But he was outside the door drunk the whole time, and every comic blew the light. You know, Urban Room. That's all I'll say about that. You know what I mean? People just they ignore the light when the host is not in there, kind of managing him and saying, "Get off. You're next. You're next." So everyone's going. You know, blows the light. He doesn't even get on. We bring all the camera equipment. We blow a day. What a fucking pain in the ass. But CJ Kelly, he's definitely, he's my scene partner in the sketches. And we filmed him like 3 times already. So after this, it's a wrap on CJ Kelly's cameo. This will be our 3rd set that we capture of him. And this is like, he's got a real decent set at the Ice House. So we're going to film this.
Plus, it's his birthday.
It's his birthday, and, you know, we're going to say hi to Dave McNary, who's going to host my set on September 2nd. So, you know, we're just keeping that relationship going with Dave, so everything's cool. So,
one time I went to audition for Dave, he wasn't there, and it was because he was at the Spirit Awards, is what the guy who substituted for him was. So, but, like, he doesn't look like a dude that would be into the film industry or whatever, but it seems like a comedy.
He writes for Variety.
Oh, okay.
You know the business mag Variety?
Okay.
That's his day job.
Okay.
He's like, he goes to red carpets, like A-list red carpets, like premieres, interviews people.
It makes perfect sense.
Yes.
But then I, just from talking to him, like, he didn't, like, he seemed like a comedy, like, 100% in this.
No, I think what he says is, like, his day job is Variety, his social life is running this show, and he's married, and that's really, that's what he does. He goes to baseball games, he's married, he has got dogs, he runs.
That's the life, yeah.
Yeah, he's got a nice, simple little setup.
That's awesome.
You know, he, Dave McNary told me that he, has been running that show at the Ice House, running the auditions for them since, like, 89.
Oh.
He's had the same exact audition. You audition for the Ice House at, like, 3:30 p.m. the first Saturday of every month, and he's been doing that for, like, 30 years.
Yeah, and that's, like, a big thing. A lot of guys drive out, like, hours and hours just to audition for it, and, luckily for us, like, we're kind of, like, you're in Burbank, I'm, like, right next to it, so it's not too bad for
us. I'm in Chatsworth, but yeah.
Yeah.
But, yeah, we didn't waste the day. After we found out we couldn't film today, we hopped in a camera store. I'm like, we're not buying anything, we're not buying anything, we're not buying anything. And then we buy, like, $300 of stuff.
Yeah.
But we have a good setup, like, you know, there's stuff that's going to be yours at the end of the shoot. There's stuff that's going to be mine at the end of the shoot. So we're kind of splitting the cost like that. Like, if it's yours, I'll pitch in because it's going to mainly be used, like, specifically for this. But then you have it for all projects after that. So, you know, we're itemizing the budget pretty carefully. Excuse me. And we're,
I think it's a great way to approach making making things.
Yeah, we're like business partners.
Exactly.
In this.
Because it's not like we're not going to work, like, together again on the future, like after this is done, like, when you build your next special, like, a couple
years
from now.
We're
going to
do the same thing.
Yeah.
We kind of have it planned. We're going to do this special in 2018, and we'll probably shoot the next special in 2022, if everything goes well, with the same exact equipment. Because we already bought it, we spent thousands of dollars on it. Maybe we'll get
it's like future
this
proof.
Or that.
Like,
yeah.
I was actually watching a thing recently that, like, 4K is, like, the absolute, like, if you went up to 8K, which some people do, they spent like $50,000 on these red 8K cameras. They were saying that the human eye, like, literally, it cannot tell any difference because, like, the human eye is actually designed pretty poorly because there's only so in 8K resolution, there's, I can't remember all the numbers, but I'm going to say, like, let's say if, okay, I'm going to get some numbers wrong, but if it's 8 million pixels, the human eye only has, like, 4 million cones, and each of those cones, you have to divide those by 3, because each cone is for, there's 3 different color cones, green, red, and blue, I believe.
Yeah.
And so you divide 4 million by 3, and that's, like, a third of whatever that is. I'm not like a math guy, but I guess it's 1.25 million, everybody's not listening to the podcast anymore, but
no, we have 4K cameras, 8K, your eye can't even, it doesn't have the resolution to tell the difference between
exactly.
The next notch up of technology. We got 4K cameras.
It's like future proof.
Yeah, we're just gonna keep shooting on these, unless, you know, unless there's a camera that comes out that has smell-o-vision or that shoots in natural 3D, that, like, when you watch a movie, you just, like, put a chip in your butt and you put, like, an Oculus Rift on and, like, you know what I mean? But for now, if it's filmed in a screen, we have the best stuff that the future can possibly divide.
Exactly.
Based on the resolution of one's eyes. But anyway, this has been pretty intense project. Like, every time we go out to shoot, we've been It's weird. It's like when you go out to shoot the same thing over and over and over again, like a lot of people like just do a stand-up special, right? So it'll be like, oh, I booked the theater the 14th, 15th, and 16th. We're going to do two shows on Thursday, two shows on Friday, one show on Saturday. I'm going to wear the same shirt. I'm going to do the same hour, and we're just going to run the hour five times in the same location. We're like shooting sketches, multiple days of sketch shootings. We're doing, we're getting cameos, multiple days of cameos, meaning like people that have a little 5 minutes, 2 minutes here, 2 minutes here on my special. It's mostly going to be my special, but then we'll have cameos. So we're shooting the third round of CJ Kelly's cameo today. Then we're going to go on the road and shoot 30 shows of mine and a bunch of shows of Skylar's as well. Probably like 7 shows for Skylar.
And hopefully
to get
one
a cameo.
Of them, yeah, gets
yeah.
a cameo.
And we'll, you know, I'm going to come by in January and we'll make all those decisions when we start getting some rough cuts of this together. Of like what cameo goes where, what piece of material goes where.
Yeah.
And,
and you don't gotta softball me, but the one at the Ice House main room.
Yeah.
Do you think that was a whole stone there?
And here's the thing about that: you
yeah.
did your famous Jared Fogle joke that
yeah.
I told you I liked, and I think that's the best representation of that joke.
Okay.
And I think you should move on from that material.
Okay.
Like how I'm doing like multiple
mm-hmm.
bits. Like I think you got that bit. Like mark that
like
off.
Like I was
in
saying
your,
with
the yeah,
other
yeah.
thing. Check it off. Oh yeah, I agree with that. Like and plus,
so.
I'll never. It's not like I'm gonna get on the main stage again. It was a fluke that I got on.
I know it's cool. We showed up to open mic, and that's the next time we're gonna record. By the way, is we're gonna do Wednesday again, and then we're gonna go do Sunday. For the sketch.
Okay.
And then I think we're going to go, the next day is Monday.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to go right off room. We're going to go Ice House again. We're going to go Thursday, Skip Town. And then we're going to go Sunday. I think that's it.
Very cool.
For, Sunday, the Dave McNary show for next week. So that's our schedule, our shooting schedule.
Sure.
That thing is a beast, that hard drive,
yeah.
man.
We got a 700, I don't know, I can't remember. What is
12
it?
Terabytes.
12, yeah, 12 terabytes.
That's the big thing. You know, I went down to the Comedy Store one night to talk to Tom Rhodes about specials, and he kind of had like a nightmare scenario where he hired a guy like you, and then the guy like, you know, fucked him over, didn't give him his stuff back, didn't give him, but I think like, you know, part of what may have failed in that relationship is like, you know, this drive, like I've, like up front we got the 12 terabyte hard drive and I bought that and that's where the footage lives, that's where the footage is edited from, and then I just get this like black box back at the end that has all the footage, but
mm-hmm.
that's gonna be years from now because you have to edit the specials on it, and then we're also doing this documentary project like behind the scenes of recording the specials that also is going to be on that drive, so that's you know, you're gonna have it for 2 years, but once those
yeah.
four assets are delivered,
and
then
by 2 years from now you
yeah.
might be ready for the next road trip. You might be ready.
No, 4 years, man. I'm telling you, I'm really stuck on that, on it taking 4 years to
yeah.
come up with another hour because you know, it's not, it's, I don't want to rush it.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm blowing like, you know, 90
yeah.
minutes of material on this, and I'm gonna slowly, you know, figure out, you know.
There's,
I don't want to rush.
There's, so you edited, all the audio together, of,
yeah.
Stuff from New Orleans.
Yeah.
And it's so, it's already, like, over 90 minutes, and some
mm.
of that's, like, not even stuff that's going to be on, so you have some carryover.
That's true. And, like, yeah, so
I think you'll surprise yourself.
So, like, to construct this, project, what I did is I took all my sets from New Orleans, where I kind of developed my hour. When I lived down there for the last 3 years, from 2014 to 2017, I recorded all my sets, and I constructed, like, first I constructed a screenplay, like, special one is these jokes in a row, special two is these jokes in a row, special three is these jokes in a row. So I have a paper version of that, but then I also found all those bits, and I selected the best time I ever did that bit from the audio from New Orleans, and I put the whole special together via audio. And there's even little ad-libs in there, extra pieces. So we're going to lay that down on the timeline and just replace those bits with filmed bits in 4K as we do this road trip. But there's there was so much material when I was going through that. I was like, wait a minute, I did a lot of crowd work in these rooms that was really funny, but it doesn't really fit into the screenplay because I was like riffing with the audience. So I was like, I think I have a whole other crowd work special. But then in that crowd work special, there's all these bits that for some reason or the other, I didn't feel like fit into this. So I do have like extra material, and that's the next stage after we finish all this, is to find out from that crowd work special what bits I should take from that. And I did take some bits from that and move them, graduated them to the proper special as I, you know, put everything together. But anyway, it's just trying to organize my jokes, trying to make sure I don't do the same joke twice on two different specials. But, you know, in this whole process, where it's like many, many layers. We did a whole audio version. We're doing a whole filmed version. We're doing a film version several times. We're filming several sketches on top of each other. So we're trying to put all these vegetables in a pot, chop them as fine as we can, and try to make the best fine course meal. We're trying to compete with people that have, like, actual fucking budgets, you know? Yeah. And we're both, like, pretty big on the idea that, like, you know, the people that get the nicest theater and do five shows in a nicest tuxedo in front of the nicest white people audience, like, they have, like, millions of dollars that they're blowing for something that kind of sucks. Like, if they spent that money instead of, like, the biggest crowd, if they just spent it on a skeleton crew and just bought pieces of production equipment here and there as needed, I don't know. I just feel like we're getting way more value because we're putting, like, effort in where we don't have the budget for. We don't have a big budget of have a nice film crew, so we'll have a small film crew and just shoot way more and then cut it down, distill it, you know?
I think it comes with something more valuable because it's more honest. And in the stand-up special, that's what I want to see is I want to have an intimate experience with someone's monologue. Like, essentially, it's their inner monologue. And like way too much glitz and glamour, and all the stuff that would go into the average, like quintessential stand-up special, all of that's lost, and so much of it is lost. But this is going to be like a super, like stripped down. Like it, I feel like it's just going to be more honest performance. Like you and bars around the country and venues. There's some theater shows, but even though it's like it's just going to be like a way more raw experience, and I feel like that's what comedy should be like.
Yeah, we're going to shoot like 30, you know, bars. We have some black box theaters, some decent venues, some smaller bars, whatever we have, but what's cool about it is, like, every joke is going to be, like, in a different venue. So I think visually it's going to be so much more interesting than someone who stands in front of a curtain for an hour.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Tom Rhodes told me that on one of his specials, the jib operator, a jib crane is like a massive crane that the camera swoops in and out of. And he goes, the jib rental and the jib guy made like twice as much as he did for the show. So like all the ticket prices, they just went to pay the jib guy.
Wow.
And it's like, so you got this cool crane shot, but still it's like I don't know, it is beautiful and glitz and glam, but I mean I was telling Tom Rhodes, I saw you at the like he's in the packed OR of the Comedy Store murdering. It's like just have two cameras on either side doing that, and like if he has like three of those shows a week, if he has someone do at the same venue for a month and then just cut the best, like, you know, you could spend that one jib operator could be like a month of like USC students Uber there and back. You know what I mean? So it's like really like, okay, what is the budget? What can you afford? What's the best way to manage that budget and get the same? And I just think it's like more performances. You know, you always have a weird crowd. some crowds are great and some crowds are not so great. But even in a not so great, if the crowd, if the show's going a certain way and then there's a little heckling or crowd work, you can kind of have like a contentious moment with a heckler, and it can make it into the special. But it could like cut to, as long as you deal with it well, but then there's other venue under their venue. It's not like you only have one audience and one jib crane that costs 10 grand. And then if someone heckles you, it's like ruined. It's like, we can, you know, use that or not, but we're shooting so much more shows, so much more. And then we're just cutting the best of the best of the best. And then we're also having this documentary that's probably going to take another year after the specials drop. Especially if we get a good deal for the specials, hopefully we can attach this documentary to it. But there's also, let me ask you this, Skyler, why did you decide to put so much effort into helping me make a special?
Because I've seen your stuff when I was at New Orleans, when we met in New Orleans, and I noticed, like, the sentience to your material, and then stage presence, and that was at the Wolf, where the first time that I saw, and then again at Siberia, that's when we like talked a little bit outside, mm-hmm. And then just kind of fate had it, I was getting together with Xander Forrest in Los Angeles, and then came to, and we just hung out in my truck while I played, I think, Conker's Bad Fur Day, and
I think we played some Star Fox as well.
That was the next day when Nintendo. Yeah, when we did the podcast. So
yeah, and we went to the Comedy Store.
Mm-hmm. So like, I'm like not an adult comedian or whatever, because like instead of podcasts and things, like I've been doing like Let's Plays, which is like the probably like the least thing of merit that you could possibly do. It's almost like a
In a D&D club. I was just at your nerd headquarters.
Exactly, yeah. Like I played D&D I've been doing it every Wednesday, but for the project
I've been cutting into your D&D time for these shows.
But it's gonna be worth it. It's definitely gonna be worth it. But we just clicked. We played some Star Fox together. And
my sentience on stage.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Like, it's like a lot. You've seen guys up there. It seems like someone can write a joke, but not yet. If I get like too much into it, it sounds like elitist.
Hey, as long as you're giving this guy compliments, it'll sound great on my ears.
Yeah.
Anyone can write a joke.
Yeah, like, anybody can write a joke. Most people can write a joke. And then, like, I'm going to say the average comedian around Los Angeles can write a joke. And, like, you have, like, an energy to you, like, that you only see with like seasoned performers, but you're still young, like, so the more you're like ahead of the game when it comes to your writing and delivery, which to me, like, everybody is all a stand-up.
And also, I'm telling you, listen, I'm ready.
Yeah.
Let's do it, you know. And I think part of my strategy in like keeping you, I paid you $220 and I gave you like $200 for equipment, but you've like spent more than all of that on equipment, but that's like for your future, you own this equipment now, that's like top level shit, so I've like been putting like not your full, I haven't been, and I feel bad because I can't pay you like $5,000 up front, which is like what the amount of work, or like $10,000 is like the amount of work that you're putting into this. And maybe even more, $10,000 for production, and then I would probably owe you like $40,000 for, you know, post production on this. But I think we're like we both are like kind of business partners on this, because neither of us could afford each other's services, mm-hmm. so we're both volunteering each other's services. And I've just been, you know, I put a screenplay for how this special goes together. And I've been trying just to, like, do as much or as much effort as you are in just, like, prepping. Like, I have a big bag of Barbies. I got 2 Barbie dream cars. I, you know, did the audio of all the specials before we start. So I'm, like, really trying hard to show you that, like, I'm not just going to, like, take advantage. I'm not just like, oh, film me, do awesome shit. And then it all work out,
and
you know.
A lot of that's essentially what a Big Mike, like,
yeah.
If I was here, like, bark up his tree or anybody else. But yeah, I remember it was that the very beginning of this year, like probably like December, I started putting together this my first and probably last cinema grade camera. That's all I'm gonna need. But I put it together. And, like, I was running around Hollywood. Like, you remember when I was on the phone, I was like, yo, let's hang out. I'm running around Hollywood just buying pieces and parts of this camera. So I got it all together, and then I was, like, looking at it, and I was like, man, what am I going to do with this? And then I met you at the Comedy Store, like, that night or
I picked you up, and I drove you to the Comedy Store to do the potluck open mic. And you were like, hey, I got this camera. What do you want to shoot? I'm like, I know exactly what the fuck we're going to use that for. This.
And my original idea was essentially, like, every comedian and their mom who has an idea for a sitcom or some kind of show is always, like, the same kind of thing. It's always, like, a little self-indulgent Louis kind of knockoff slash Larry David's show, Curb Your Enthusiasm knockup. So that's what I essentially wanted to, I was pitching to you at the Comedy Store. I was like, we should do like some kind of
thing, documentary, like, sitcom pilot.
Exactly, yeah. And you're like, well, this is my bag. This, I got stand up and I got some sketch, and that's
and the thing is, I've made two pilots. You know, one of them was with Devin, and we did this thing called Here Comes Godot, which I think is hilarious. It's, like, a really good, like, sitcom pilot, but the problem is we're all nobodies, and we can't get anybody to, like, watch it seriously. We put it in a bunch of festivals, and we may have played at one festival, and we put it at our own premiere together and tried to, like, invite industry. We put out postcards to, like, every agent and manager to, like, come and see our premiere. Like, only, like, friends and family came, and it, you know, we premiered it. It still lives on YouTube. It's called Here Comes Godot. It's hilarious. I also made another thing called Damien Shadows. I made one pilot that's 16 minutes, and then I made 3 10-minute web series, and I think they're all hilarious, but they're pilots for a nobody that showcases a nobody. But a stand-up special is a pilot, but it's kind of like a standalone thing. It's like a special, because it takes like 10 years to do the material for a stand-up special, so it's like a 10-year pilot. And also, like, not everybody can do a stand-up, like, write their own original jokes and put out their own original jokes. So I've gone the sitcom route before, but, like, a special, that's something. And I also tried to do a Kickstarter, like, a year ago. I tried to raise the money, and, like, I fell short of the thing. So it's been something, like, for over a year that I've wanted to, over 2 years I've wanted to produce. But now I think I'm, like, the most ready after doing that editing to create the 90-minute version of the audio version and, like, listening to that track a million times to edit it together. I like, brainwashed myself. We're like, I'm like thinking of the jokes at night. I'm like showering at the gym, just talking to myself, telling the bits. Like, it like got into my soul. So I'm super fired up. A couple of the dates are in the air. That's why I haven't booked the hotels yet. But we're talking about, you know, we're 2 weeks away from hitting the road. Crazy, man.
Yeah. You were talking about your show Bible, or not your show. You were talking about the pilot that you made, and then the guy who you made the pilot with, who helped with the filming of the sketches, he was talking about the show Bible that you guys made, and how it's like a script without a script, or
Are you talking about for Here Comes Godot?
I believe so.
Yeah, so we made you know how, like, Curb Your Enthusiasm, they'll have, like, beats of this happens, then this happens, then this happens, and maybe there'll be a line of dialogue, but it's not wrote. That's kind of how we wrote. It's, like, very much, when we were doing it, we did a lot of improvising. We wrote some beats out. Like, this argument, they argue about this, or they argue about... Oh, shit, CJ Kelly. CJ Kelly.
Yo, what's up, buddy?
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
Thanks, guys. We just got here, so I'll see you guys soon. I'm not going up to, like, 7, so you're good.
Okay, yeah, we're around the corner. We're 5 minutes away, but we're...
Perfect. Cool. Well, we got some ganj if you want to... Actually, I'm not going to smoke before my set, but, you know, I'll get some drinks or something.
I'll have a little bit of your weed. We got to buy a cable. I got to buy, like, a little cable just to, like, plug the audio into my thing. So we'll get there, like, 6:45.
Cool. All right.
All right, buddy.
Later.
So, remember when I was talking about, I'm trying to build a story Bible, but before I even build a story Bible, I'm building a bare bones, I'm borrowing, essentially, it's right now it's kind of based on
Joseph Campbell's
hero's journey, and this is what I've made in Illustrator so far. It's like you're gonna be the most basest pieces of what a story would need, and then I'm going to essentially just keep setting it up until everything's there. Right now I feel like it's pretty well
This is kind of beautiful. Exactly. So what he's done here is I'm looking at a visual picture of like a wheel where at the top of the wheel is a protagonist is missing something in an ordinary world. So think of like Frodo Baggins in the Shire. Like, it's nice in the Shire, everything's ideal, but there's something wrong. Like, you know, these goblins come in and they rape our women, so I gotta go out and throw the Ring of Sauron into Mount Doom.
And I've made, like, Illustrator depictions of each section to be, like, instantly, so I don't even have to read. I'll be like, this, it has to...
Yeah, it's a very visual wheel of...
So you don't even have to read English to understand.
Then it's like the protagonist refuses... the call to action, then he finally commits to the quest after a supernatural mentor gives him the right motivation, then they go on the quest and blah blah blah. Over here they lose something, they use some of the guru's magic to,
and all of the sections reflect the opposite part of the story.
Interesting.
So I have it color coded as far as that. There's the ordinary world and then the other world in black and white, and there's like I'm like visually making it so that these things, these pieces of information that would are kind of cerebral and less you can less put your finger on it, I'm making it so that it's literally like mapped out on a page. And then on top of all of that, so this is what I have so far, and it's kind of bad to use a visual thing on a podcast, but this is the inner circle. It has all the base things, and then I'd start filling. I'm gonna make like a logic tree that extends outwards, where I start filling in blanks, and then I fill in longer blanks down to where there's dialogue script, which is the most minute detail, and these things on the very furthest parts of the wheel that I only have two of right now will be storyboard, the art. So I'll literally have frames of each keyframe, of each important keyframe that tells the story, to the point that that I can scroll around the wheel and understand what happens in the story.
Like the chronological order, you just go around the wheel and then the next scene happens. I think, you know, that wheel is a great model for the documentary.
Exactly,
and maybe
yeah.
It's like more emotional beats. Maybe it's more like, you know, we're here, you know, I'm in the middle of Houston. We just bombed like two shows in a row that we had high hopes for. And I'm like, you know, drinking behind the thing. I'm like throwing up behind a dumpster in the in the middle of Alabama going, fuck my life, fuck my project. No, I'm just joking. But, Yeah, hopefully we don't reach the dark night of the soul.
Yeah.
But, you know, we are going to one of the first people that we were both around, that we both, you know, that is almost like this Obi-Wan Kenobi of this whole project is John Rowe, who, you know, we met at Siberia with John Rowe, this extremely charismatic but kind of troubled beneath the surface comic that was like the funniest guy in New Orleans for a long time, but just like his personal life and his he just, you know, was totally impractical, where, you know, he kind of didn't take care of his body, and he would drink in the morning, and, you know, he was popping pills all the time, and he had a seizure, basically killed himself drinking and doing pills, you know. And but we're gonna visit his grave, so maybe that'll be like, and I get really emotional just thinking about John, you know, talking about him, visiting his grave. It's gonna be really emotional, just because, like, it's really surreal to have a friend like that. Like, when I lived in New Orleans, like, he was like really him and Kyle Smith were my best friends. And look at that lady's side boob. But anyway, they were like my best friends. I saw them every single day for 3 years. Every day, multiple times a week. I would drive them to shows all the time. My first year, I didn't have a car, so 2014, John had a car. He drove me to shows all the time. Then when I got a car in 2015, then I drove him to shows all the time. And we just saw each other all the time. I drove up to the airport to move to Los Angeles, and then it wasn't long after that he was dead. He came out here, and I just think the big city. You know, he was the king in New Orleans. He walked into every bar, and somebody knew him, and somebody, you know, would buy him a drink or whatever. And then he comes to Los Angeles, and, like, nobody knows him. He's at the bottom of the barrel, but he's in a place where he can maybe strike some kind of ethereal success. And I think that the fear of getting close to the success and not living up to it or something like that kind of, like, spiraled his demons out of control. So, I don't know. I think that's also part of why we bonded, because we both understand him and, like, how funny he was and how much talent he had. And, like, it's almost like I want to do what he could have done but didn't live long enough to do. It's like he wanted to make a special. You know, he wanted to do this. And it's like, you know, I almost feel like
I wish he was still around. Like, that'd be so cool to have him be a part of this trip. And, like, if he was still, like, I'd imagine we'd still be, like, if he didn't get sick of living with me, he'd, like, we'd probably still be doing stuff together.
Yeah, it's just like, you know, he came out here with no money, he didn't have a job, he didn't have anything lined up, and it was just like, he just drank off of credit cards until his head exploded. It's just real sad, but it's like, I don't feel like I want to, it's not honoring his life to, go down his path, you know, it's not honoring what I learned from his mistakes, it's not honoring, like, it's almost like a hypocritical tale, you know. I want to learn from that, I want to, you know, do what he should have done, which is, like, do a special and start to get notoriety. I don't know what to say. It makes me emotional to talk about him, but it's just like, I don't know. It's just sad to see all of his potential wasted, and I don't want to waste my potential. I want to, like, what little talent I have, I want to, like, overemphasize it.
Yeah. I feel like there's, like, a million ways to the mountaintop, and there's lots of guys who, or when I was in New Orleans, I just kind of, like, assumed that everybody, like, I was hanging out with Keegan, and, he drank at the, I probably shouldn't say this, Keegan's the best, nicest dude in the world, and hilarious and awesome, and he even, offered to let me, sleep in his, on his couch, which I believe I did, and he was just the coolest dude in the world. But I'm just saying that, like, everybody in New Orleans, it's a part of the culture there, like, to party, and it's a huge party city. So, and every place, every business is a it serves alcohol and is like a little bohemian thing. So, yeah, it's just like it's a part of like it's nothing bad. Like there's it was just like an accident, like that. It happened, but it was part of the magic of John, and the twinkle in his eye, like, was a little bit, like, devil may care, but also, like, super, super warm, and,
Yeah, like, he knew he was being reckless, he knew he was being ridiculous, but it's like, he just didn't, he just wanted to, I don't know. He just wanted to drink. Yeah, he just wanted to have fun.
Which is important.
He just wanted to be your friend. He didn't want to work. He didn't want to whatever. But yeah, like, Keegan's a big drinker, too. And, you know, I was a big drinker in New Orleans, too. But it's like, I had to keep it together enough to get good grades at grad school and to, like, be an Uber and Lyft driver. So there was, like, big blocks where I had to be sober, where I had to drive people around, you know. So that kind of kept the New Orleans, like, devil away. But it is a trap, you know, and I moved right out of there after because I don't know, I just felt like, whether I was a great joke writer or not the best joke writer, you know, people don't notice as much because I think everybody has, like, a little bit of inebriation on top of it, you know what I mean? Not that that's different than any city, but, yeah, I don't know. New Orleans is a crazy place. You know, if you're an addict, it's probably not a good place to live because, you know, if you're an alcoholic, nobody's going to tell you no. Nobody's going to say, oh, no, you shouldn't have that 15th drink because everyone is just on that vibe.
I think it's like college or something. Like, yeah. Like, there's, in the college that I went to, which was UCF, like, it's a part of the culture where, like, you have to get wasted to have fun with everybody else, and it's just like it's I don't think it's like the worst thing in the world, especially when you're young and you're taking care of the things you need to take care of. Like, John really didn't have a lot he needed to take care of other than stand-up comedy. Like, he was a purist, that's all he wanted in life, and he was super good at it, and he was taking care of that because he'd go to mics and he'd do well, or he'd do he'd kill it all the mics around Los Angeles, and he was just so I feel like for his path, like it's just a terrible accident, but he didn't do anything. Anything that, like, bad things happen sometimes.
Yeah, he just wasn't a creature of moderation, you know? It's like, I'll have a couple drinks, I'll have a couple beers, I'll go up, but it's not like, he would want to do a show, drink during the show, and then, like, afterward, after every show, like, what bar are we going? I'm like, motherfucker, I'm going home, I'm doing homework. I'm going to jerk off and go to sleep. I'm going to wake up. I'm going to work. Then I'm going to do more homework. Then I'm going to go to a show. Then it's like, where are we going now? It's like, home, motherfucker. The show was the thing. But it was always like, let's go out and get drunk and then kind of celebrate our good sets. But I would always kind of try to, like, nip it off in the bud after. But there's no denying that. Like, he was, like, way funnier than me most of the time. You know, there's no denying that. Like, despite how crazy he was with the booze, like, he was like the funniest person in the room, just like undeniably, like the audience would laugh more at him than a lot of people, or sometimes he was the best or the worst, he was never in between, but when he was the best, I mean, there was like nobody that could touch him, and it's just
but even if the crowd wasn't like with it, he never bombed because
He was just so charismatic and so confident that it's like he didn't really bomb.
Like, when I bomb, I flop sweat. When I don't bomb, I flop sweat, and I barely get through what I'm trying to say or whatever. Right. And then when I do bomb, I definitely, like, that's the only way I can describe it, is just, like, tongue-tied, flop sweat, loss of words.
Yeah, I've had those shows before.
John would never be like that, like, just because, like, he's literally just having an open conversation. He's not, like, he's not, like, doing all the neurotic things that I did, like...
Yeah, he has, like, zero, insecurity.
Exactly, yeah.
But that comes from, like, you know, being inebriated, but that also is just, like, his personality. Like, he just was ultra confident. He would yell at, like, there was one time, like, there was French girls over my house, and, like, you know, he's like, man, you're playing Pictionary with these girls? You should just give them hot drugs and fuck them. And I'm like, mm-hmm. bro, they're not that kind of girls, you know what I mean? But, like, he was just, like, so fucking crazy. Like, when he would give me advice about girls, like, he was on a different planet than me from, like, everything he thought about. But
that's hilarious. I saw the number of the three Italian girls from...
should call those girls.
You want to call those girls right now?
Not really. Okay. It's too... It's, like, 3 days. If it's past 3 days, then you're a weirdo.
Weird. Nah, because they're about to leave. They said they're here till September.
Like, you should try to fuck those Italian girls? Is that what you're saying?
I don't know.
There's three of them.
Yep.
Maybe we should wait until I get a motel room, if you know what I mean.
I suppose.
Bring them back.
Mm-hmm.
Bang them out. But anyway, let's talk about that off air. I don't know. It just feels good. It feels like we got a good working relationship where, you know... We don't have a contract as far as what we do, but, like, we are constantly negotiating. Like, when we walk in and you bought that shotgun mic, and we, you know, are constantly, like, renegotiating, like, on the spot, the terms of the contract. Like, we have, like, an open...
And I don't know, it's not even it's, like, literally just a, it's, like, a community, because, like, literally, what was my negotiation tactic
today? You said, hey, what do you think's fair?
Yeah, whatever you think. Yeah, man. It's just, like, we have a common goal. We're not working against each other. We're the entire world. We're not each other's competition.
Right.
Anybody that you've ever physically, or not ever, but anybody you're in physical contact with, when I say physical, I mean eye contact with, in the moment, is not your competition. A lot of guys I was in Florida, and people would be competitive in Orlando, like,
right,
about the pettiest shit in the world. Like, nobody in your local scene is your competition. Like, it's other people who are eating your lunch in a different state, in Los Angeles or New York, who you're competing against. Everybody that that you know should be family, and that is in your industry and around, like,
we should be colleagues.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, and, like, I had big problems. Like, I got banned from the Hi-Ho over a misunderstanding, and, like, there's a lot of, you know, there's even some New Orleans shows that I couldn't get on for this special recording. It's like, I'm recording a special. I went to your open mic for 2 years straight, you know, and then, like, I email these people, they don't even get back to me. It's just, like, bizarre behavior to me. It's like, because I moved to L.A. or because I'm trying to do something, they're like crabs in a bucket trying to take me down. It's like, bro, do you really want me to pass you up and then, like, have bad feelings? It's like, you know, the local scene, the New Orleans comedy scene, is just college for a bigger scene. So you're just training there for multiple years so that when you do move to a big scene, or you do... Maybe you shoot a special in New Orleans and you get good in New Orleans, but then to go national, to be a national headliner and to take the next step where you're just making money every day, I think, in my personal opinion, you have to live in New York or you have to live in LA, and those are the only two cities in America where you can make a living doing this full time after you have a special. So a Florida comedy scene, a New Orleans comedy scene, a Nashville comedy scene, you guys are colleagues. And if you have beef with anybody or whatever, you got to nip it in the bud. And, you know, as many times as I've had podcasts about being banned from the Hi-Ho, okay, those people who banned me from the Hi-Ho, that person, has had every opportunity to be on my podcast, every opportunity to roast battle me at the Comedy Store, every opportunity to talk to me off stage, and they've refused every ability to, like, I'm trying to, like, let's be friends, like, you know, and then when I was douched enough times, and I go, okay, motherfucker, I'm going to put out a podcast about this and say my side of the story, and you're not going to like it, you know what I mean? So, like, I almost, like, put out the Band from High Hope podcast after several olive branches were shat on. And I said, okay, let me tell you what you look like to me right now. And then, you know, maybe that caused some bad blood, but I don't know. I didn't want to have these beefs. I was trying to be everyone's friend all the time because I understand, like, we're colleagues. Like, look at the power of, Joe Rogan with Ari Shaffir, with Duncan Trussell, with his whole clique. Sam Tripoli, there's this clique of comics that help each other. Tom Segura, Christina P. Like, there's all these comics that help each other in this collective. Bill Burr, they have this. There's a website called the All Things Comedy Network where it's like a collective of a bunch of comedians pooled their money into like this podcast collaboration where they all put their podcasts on the same thing so it's easy for fans to like go from one to the other, and they're all friends working together. Why are you noticing in Florida the competition, and why am I noticing in New Orleans there's certain people that have their cliques? It's like, that's the opposite of, you know?
Yeah, like, that's not the time to be scratching and clawing your way to the top and then bringing up ladders, and because what have you climbed on top of, like, really? Like, it's, like, a host of an open mic, at a club that that other comedians go to that are local, and which isn't bad to be a local comic. Like, and plus, you don't have to come to Los Angeles. Like, you can do what you want, but just be peaceful about it. And it doesn't make sense to go to war against against someone who's like against your neighbor. It's like keeping up with the Joneses. Like, that guy's not your enemy. The guy across the street or even on your block isn't your enemy, and is definitely not your enemy, and isn't your competition. Like, they're not taking any food.
Yeah, I
from
think
you.
That like because like when you start in a small scene, you go, oh well,
this is
you.
Yeah, I see. Gets.
You see that, that guy got booked on that show, and that was my spot. So, like, in the short term, you might think, oh, someone else is taking my spot. But in the long term, if you're cool and you don't, you know what I mean? Another spot's going to come around the corner the next week, and it's going to go to you. So you can't have this, like, short-term thinking of, like, oh, there's competition, you
Do
know?
Do you have the tripod? No biggest
Yours?
Goal.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, cool.
We gotta actually get going now to go record CJ Kelly's set, so, and we gotta buy a cord and all that stuff, but anyway, work together, people, form collectives. It's the only way that we have a shot with our liberal arts degree against the fucking machine, you know?
Yeah, like, just two guys, and then some others coming together that are able to make what we're making
now. We've plucked certain people to help out with certain things here and there, but really it's just us two kind of organizing all this footage onto a drive so that, you know.
It's not like a war. Like, no one's going to strike. That's another thing when it comes to people attacking each other. Like, good for you, you block somebody out of, you submarine someone's opportunity with one thing. Well, it's not like you didn't kill them, because we're in the 21st
right.
century. They're still around, and they're also still in this industry, and they're gonna stay doing things, so
right.
it's not
You've
even...
just actually created, like, an enemy. Like,
yeah.
Like, in the future, there's a couple people where, if I'm asked about them, I'm going to say, no, fuck that guy. You know why? Because that guy kept banned me from the hi-ho. You know why fuck that guy? Because that guy kept me out of the House of Blues. You know? And if that's you, yeah, fuck you. Because I have not forgotten that I was kept out of the House of Blues when I was promised a set. So fuck you, and I'm gonna get my revenge, cocksucker. And all I'm doing, the only thing that motivates me and gets my dick hard in the morning to do this special is to one day really fuck you over. So maybe I shouldn't say that, but that's real.
Well, yeah.
I mean, I'm like kind
of
like
there instead of hyperbole, but
it's hyperbole, but it's like, look, I'm gonna prove to you that you fucked up, man. All right, that's been another episode of Highway Diary in the motherfucker bag with Skylar Neal. We're about to take over the world. Later.